This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this election day, we're going to look back at last year's presidential election, the election that wasn't decided until a Supreme Court decision 36 days later. My guest, Jeffrey Toobin, covered the election court cases for ABC News and The New Yorker magazine. After the Supreme Court decision, he continued to investigate what happened behind the scenes. Now he has a new book called Too Close to Call. Toobin is also the author of the best-selling books A Vast Conspiracy, about the impeachment of President Clinton, and The Run of His Life, about the O.J. Simpson trial. The recount story isn't over yet. A recount of the presidential vote was commissioned by a consortium of the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, the New York Times, and CNN. The consortium expects to publish its results later this month. Jeffrey Toobin did not conduct a recount, but he concludes, based on his analysis of voting irregularities, that more people intended to vote for Gore than Bush. Jeffrey Toobin, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Good to be with you.
I'm sure you never expected to be reporting the results of your book during a war against terrorism. Some people think this is an inappropriate time to be going back over the contested election. What are your thoughts about going back over it in this context?
I don't know about inappropriate. I think it may be unfortunate for me, but I don't think George Bush is sitting up nights worrying about my book. I think this is a work of history. Too Close to Call is a book about something that happened last year and is an exploration of something that remains very important. But I'm not a politician. I'm not trying to get the vote overturned. George Bush is a legitimate president. He's the commander-in-chief of the military. But this was a very troubled and troubling election, and the events of September 11th don't change that.
Now, you say in your book that the way the Bush team and the Gore team went about their recount strategy said a lot about Bush and Gore and some of the differences between them. Can you talk about some of those differences as they manifested themselves during the recount?
Al Gore is a creature of Washington and the Capitol establishment. He is someone who wakes up every morning and reads the New York Times editorial page and really cares about how he's described there. He cares about being thought a bipartisan person, about being thought a statesman, and about the values that are transmitted over in establishment channels like the Times and the Washington Post editorial pages. George Bush is not a creature of Washington. He is someone who grew up outside that world and doesn't particularly care much about it or for it. And what that led to, and I think what it led to in our politics, both in the recount, during the Clinton years, and after September 11th, is that the Republican Party, National Republican Party, is a tougher, more ruthless organization than the Democrats are. And the Democrats spend a lot more time worrying about how they will be perceived rather than whether they will win. And I think that difference between the two parties is both profound and profoundly important in the resolution of this 36-day struggle.
Well, you say that the Bush team was willing to take risks to bet their careers and bear almost any burden for Republican victory. Your implication is that the Democrats were not willing to go that far for Gore. Was there a lack of interest or faith in Gore, or was there just a fear on the part of the Democrats that they would be perceived as challenging an election that shouldn't have been challenged?
I think there were two forces at work here, at least two. One relates to Gore and Bush specifically. The people around George Bush absolutely love the man. When you're talking about people like Karl Rove, Karen Hughes, Joe Albaugh, these are people who have staked their lives, their professional lives, on George Bush's success, and they were going to do what it took. If George Bush lost this election, their careers were deeply, deeply injured, if not ruined. The people around Al Gore did not have that same level of commitment. You know, of the two dozen or so people around Gore that I spoke to, precisely one wanted to see him run again. This is a guy, Al Gore, who received more votes for president than anyone in American history except Ronald Reagan in 1984, and his own people didn't even want to see him run again. I mean, there was just a personal magnetism gap between the candidates that was extremely important. The other factor is the Clinton years. For eight years, the Republican Party had been beside itself with loathing for Bill Clinton, and one time after another, he slipped out of their grasp. They managed to impeach him, but they never really closed the deal. The recount allowed all of that passion to be transferred to a new cause, winning this recount. And the Democrats had no comparable source of inspiration. And I think so those two points, the personal appeal of the candidates and the Clinton legacy, contributed to the passion gap a lot.
You write a little bit about how David Boies became Gore's lead lawyer. And I was interested to read that he wasn't necessarily the first choice.
No. Again, an example of how Gore did not have a network of people who were personally loyal to him. He and Boies had never met except for once briefly at a dinner. And Ron Klain and Walter Dellinger, who were two lawyers working part-time for Gore, they sort of sat around one day right near the beginning of the recount, and they said, well, who's the best lawyer we can get? And they came up with two names. One was David Boies, and the other was Joel Cohen, who was the head of the antitrust division in the Clinton administration. And so what they did was they had a race. Klain called Boies and Dellinger called Cohen, and they saw who would say yes first. As it turned out, Boies was readily available. Cohen had just gotten married and was on his honeymoon. So that's how David Boies was hired. It turned out to be a very good decision. Boies did a great job. But again, an example of how there was not a Gore network in place.
Did you talk to Boies directly, and did he have any regrets about his strategy?
I did speak to Boies at length, and I thought one of he was given a good deal of free rein, but some of his regrets related to an overall theme of too close to call. One of his big regrets was related to Seminole and Martin counties in Florida. And if you recall, Seminole and Martin were counties where the Republican Party organized an absentee ballot drive, and they distributed applications for absentee ballots, and they were sent in by Republican voters. Well, it turns out they were defective applications. They didn't ask for all the information, and Republican Party operatives were allowed to set up shop within these Republican Party offices and edit the applications that their people had made. Clearly, it seems, in violation of how Florida law should work. Boies thought that they should have asked to have all those ballots thrown out, and it was several thousand ballots. Gore overruled him on that, saying, you know, we're committed to the policy of count all the votes. I'm not going to try to exclude these votes because that would be an inconsistent argument. The Bush campaign never had the slightest worry about making inconsistent arguments, but that was just the kind of self-censorship that Gore was involved, you know, characterized his effort. You know, you can argue that that was a statesmanlike, honorable thing to do. You can also argue that it made Al Gore the man on the lecture circuit that he is today.
You say in your book that it was David Boies' strategy to lose quickly in the Leon County Court, where Judge Ensander Saul was presiding, because he wanted to get to the Florida Supreme Court as quickly as possible. Was he confident he was going to lose in Judge Saul's court?
Well, Judge Sanders Saul's, this was, I mean, again, one of the wonderful things about covering a story like Too Close to, like the Florida recount and Too Close to Call, is you see these great characters. And you know, the Leon County Circuit Court is a Tallahassee court, a medium-sized city. And Terry Lewis was a judge there. Wonderful, intelligent judge. Sanders Sauls was also a judge there who was actually, I think, one of the worst judges I have ever seen. And I think the Gore campaign recognized that they had very little chance in front of him. And if you recall, you know, by the time this was the contest part of the litigation, it was already December 1st before they got to Sanders Sauls, and they realized that they were really running out of time. So I thought Boies very cleverly did what good lawyers did, and he saw what his options were. He needed to get in front of the Florida Supreme Court because he thought his arguments would succeed there, just as he was certain they would fail in front of Judge Sauls. And he was absolutely right, and it was sort of a brilliant rope-a-dope kind of strategy, to use a Muhammad Ali reference, of just getting pounded in front of Judge Sauls. In fact, Judge Sauls ruled so overwhelmingly against the Gore campaign that it was easier for him to win, for Gore to win in front of the Florida Supreme Court, which he did win 4-3, only to be overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court.
So since it was David Boies' strategy to lose quickly in Judge Saul's court, did he try to not make a strong case or to just make as strong a case as he could in as brief a time as possible?
Well, he tried to make a strong case, but the thing that he did that was so clever was to do what lawyers say, make a record. His top priority was to get the ballots physically in evidence, get the disputed ballots from Miami-Dade County, from Palm Beach County, get them physically in evidence, because he knew that that the Florida Supreme Court would be uncomfortable with the idea of having these ballots in evidence, physically in front of Judge Sauls, and not look at them. And the Florida Supreme Court reacted, I think, quite properly, viscerally to that, and ultimately part of what the Florida Supreme Court ruled was you got to look at the ballots.
My guest is Jeffrey Toobin. He's the author of the new book, Too Close to Call. He's a legal analyst for ABC News and a staff writer for The New Yorker. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Jeffrey Toobin is my guest. He's written a new book called Too Close to Call, an investigation of the contested presidential election. Toobin is a legal analyst for ABC News and a staff writer for The New Yorker. Why was James Baker the head of the Republican effort in the recount? Why was he chosen?
Because Bush is a smart person. in simple terms, the reason why he was chosen was, if you recall, on election night, really it was still the middle of the night, the Gore campaign recruited Warren Christopher to come from Los Angeles and be the initial representative of the Gore campaign in Florida. As the Bush people sat around, Don Evans, who was the campaign chairman, now Secretary of Commerce, Joe Albaugh, they said, well, who do we have who is a comparable figure? Well, in poker, they matched Gore and then raised him one, because they said, well, we have a former Secretary of State, James Baker. But unlike Warren Christopher, James Baker was also an extremely savvy political operative. James Baker had done something that no other person in American history has done. He ran five consecutive major party campaigns for president. From 76 to 92, he ran every single Republican campaign. That kind of experience is something money can't buy. So he had the stature as a Secretary of State, but also the street fighting savvy of a campaign manager.
What are some of the new things you learned about James Baker's strategy?
Well, James Baker was hired on the Wednesday after the election, and he got a private plane with Joe Albaugh, and they flew to Tallahassee together. And they had a young staffer on the plane who gave them a briefing on what little they knew about the situation there. And just before they landed, Baker said to Albaugh, you know, this thing is going to end in the United States Supreme Court. This was on November 8th, one day after the election. And Baker had the sort of big picture savvy to recognize that this story was really just too big for Florida. And he knew that the Supreme Court couldn't help but get involved. The other thing James Baker said from the very beginning is, we need political people involved here. I want to see protesters in the streets. I want to see people outraged about this. You know, Baker was very deeply involved in the legal strategy, but he also didn't hesitate to to exert political pressure. He was behind the idea of getting surrogates in Florida. Everybody will probably remember Governor Mark Grasco of Montana, George Pataki of New York, Christy Whitman of New Jersey, how they all came down to Florida and set up shop there. That was because Baker recognized that this was not just a legal process, but it was a political process as well.
What's one of the most interesting things you feel you learned in your research for your new book that had not gone reported by the press?
To me, what always interests me in these is going behind the scenes, and particularly in an institution like the United States Supreme Court. And I learned something that I thought really was illustrative, not just of the Supreme Court, but of the whole recount. Just to refresh your recollection, everyone remembers the Supreme Court ruled 5-4 that George Bush's equal protection rights had been violated. Well, in an initial draft of her dissenting opinion, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg said that not only didn't she think George Bush's equal protection rights were violated, the only person's rights she thought violated were those of black voters in Florida. And Justice Antonin Scalia, one of the leading members of the majority, was so outraged by this claim that he wrote Justice Ginsburg a memo saying, you know, you're using Al Sharpton tactics in the Supreme Court. You're playing the race card and you shouldn't do it. So what did Ruth Bader Ginsburg do? Well, she removed that passage from her dissenting opinion. Scalia essentially intimidated her into not playing the race card. And I think it illustrates the differences, again, between the Republicans and the Democrats. The Republicans were willing to do what it took to win this election. Justice Ginsburg, like Al Gore, like Warren Christopher, was worried about how he was being perceived and how she was being perceived, and so she shied away from the confrontation. That, to me, tells you a little something about the Supreme Court and a lot about the differences between Democrats and Republicans.
My guest is Jeffrey Toobin. He's a legal analyst for ABC News and a staff writer for The New Yorker. His new book is called Too Close to Call, The 36-Day Battle to Decide the 2000 Election. One of the more controversial figures in the Florida recount was Catherine Harris, the Secretary of State in Florida. Her office is going to be abolished next year, and she will also be running for Congress next year. You conclude in your book that she was biased in favor of Bush, that she politicized her office. What leads you to that conclusion?
Well, you know, you ask about new things that I learned in the book, and I have to say this may be the single most shocking fact to me, anyway. Everybody remembers that there was what was called a machine recount, an automatic recount. The election was within 0.5%, so that under Florida law, there had to be an automatic recount of all the votes by machine in the immediate 2 days after the election. And this is what prompted Republicans to say, James Baker must have said it 50 times, the votes have been counted and recounted. And I think many of us simply took that for granted. But what I learned when I went behind the scenes in Catherine Harris's office was that there was no complete recount of the votes. Fully a quarter of all the votes in the state, 1.25 million votes, were never recounted, to this day have never been recounted, because Catherine Harris's office didn't want to take the chance that those votes would turn out to favor Gore. I mean, Harris's office, time after time after time, operated like a wholly owned subsidiary of the Republican campaign, which is what it was. And again, it was no coincidence. There is a great sort of Mistoffelian character named Max Stepanovich, sort of a Florida lobbyist, former chief of staff for a Republican governor, who called up the Bush campaign on the day after the election and said, put me to work. What can I do? And the Bush campaign sent Stepanovich to sit by Catherine Harris's side, as he did for the next several weeks, making sure that she ruled every single time in Bush's favor, which is precisely what she did.
What do you think her odds are for winning the race next year
Oh, I don't think the odds are much more than 100% that she's going to win. I mean, it's a heavily Republican district. Name recognition, to put it mildly, is not a problem for Catherine Harris in Florida. And she's going to win in a walk.
Now, today is Election Day. Have we done anything substantive in terms of election reform since last year?
Well, you know, in the intense controversy over Florida's recount, there was one point of virtually universal agreement, which was that our election laws are a disgrace, our voting technology is terrible, and we need to change that. So 1 year later, we have done almost absolutely nothing about that, and there are no signs that anything's going to be done. Florida is a honorable exception. Florida has done a serious reform of its election laws, and I think a lot of the problems that we saw there will not recur. But in other states, at the federal level, absolutely nothing has been done. And in an era when there's always a lot of competition for government resources, it's always better to just sort of put it off and ignore it. And if no one's pestering you to change, it won't change. And it hasn't changed yet.
Jeffrey Toobin is the author of the new book, Too Close to Call. He's a legal analyst for ABC News and a staff writer for The New Yorker. In the second half of the show, we'll talk with him about the new anti-terrorism law, which he wrote about in last week's New Yorker. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Jeffrey Toobin. We're going to talk about the new anti-terrorism law. Toobin is a legal analyst for ABC News and a staff writer for The New Yorker. Earlier, we talked about his new book, Too Close to Call, The 36-Day Battle to Decide the 2000 Election. You had a very interesting article in last week's New Yorker on the new anti-terrorism law and on Michael Chertoff, the Assistant Attorney General in charge of the Criminal Division of the Justice Department. And he thought that information sharing within American intelligence was a major problem. Describe the kind of problem that he felt he was up against when, after September 11th, when the real hardcore anti-terrorism investigation began.
Well, since the 1970s, there have been really two different tracks that wiretapping and eavesdropping is conducted on in American law enforcement. There is one track that is what's criminal law enforcement. When the FBI thinks that the mafia is using a social club, they tell a judge, we have probable cause to believe there is a crime, evidence of a crime in this place, and they get what's called a permission for a bug to be placed there. That's one track, the law enforcement track. The other track is national security, foreign intelligence, where the FBI says, you know, we need to put a bug in the Russian embassy because it'll help our foreign policy, and we believe it's a foreign intelligence target. That goes to a separate court called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act Court, FISA. They get what's called a FISA warrant. Well, what September 11th really illustrated to a lot of people is that the difference between national security and law enforcement is kind of a meaningless distinction now, because when you have foreign groups and foreign countries involved in committing crimes on our soil, as happened in the most dramatic way on September 11th, you need there is no distinction between what's foreign and what's domestic. The problem is that for foreign intelligence taps, the bar tends to be a lot lower. It's a lot easier to get permission to do a foreign intelligence tap. So civil libertarians were worried that if everything was a foreign intelligence tap, the FBI would simply be tapping everything. So what happened was, in this anti-terrorism bill, was that it made it easier for foreign intelligence information to be shared with law enforcement. And while that will lead to, I think, some expansion of tapping and some greater dissemination of the information gathered in those taps, it did not strike me, and it didn't strike 99 members of the U.S. Senate, as a significant infringement on civil liberties, as we've seen in this country in the past.
You give an example in your article of a person that the FBI wanted to investigate, but they couldn't get a search warrant. Would you describe that example? This was searching the computer of a French Moroccan who... go ahead.
Right. This is the fellow in Minnesota, Mr. Massoui, who in August of this year, he was one of the famous people who went to a flight school in Minnesota and said, I want to learn how to steer an airplane, but I don't want to learn how to take off and land. And he also offered to pay his fee at the flight school in cash. The system, in many respects, worked very well. The flight school alerted the local FBI. The local FBI then arrested Mr. Massoy on an immigration violation, and he's been in jail since August. He was not involved in the September 11th hijackings, although some people think he may have been destined to be the 20th hijacker. But what happened during the period of August to September is some in the FBI locally wanted to get a search warrant to examine his computer and see if there was any evidence there. And FBI headquarters said, well, we don't want to do that because we don't know whether that would be a foreign intelligence tap, and then we couldn't share it in a criminal investigation. So there was no search of his computer done before September 11th. And the problem potentially, I mean, the theory was is that maybe they would have learned something to prevent the attack. They've since examined the hard drive, and it probably wouldn't have led to stopping the attack. But that whole notion of this sort of separate systems, the problems in it, was illustrated by this strange hesitation in the Massoy case.
What are some of the history behind the difference of the standard that you need to get a warrant for a foreign case and for a local, you know, a domestic crime case?
What's interesting is in law enforcement, the standards have been pretty clear all along that, you know, you have to tell a judge you have probable cause to believe there'll be evidence of a crime, and that's how you get a law enforcement tap or bug placed. The foreign intelligence worked very differently. Until the 1970s, the FBI didn't ask for permission at all. Whenever they wanted to bug an embassy or bug a foreign intelligence target, they just went ahead and did it. But what happened during the 1970s was the courts started to say, you know, there is no way on American soil that you can just bug willy-nilly, even if it's a foreign target. There have to be some rules in place. And they established, and Congress in 1978 passed the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act that set up this system for obtaining warrants on foreign intelligence targets. So it was only since 1978 that these two tracks existed. It is a classic Cold War artifact, because in 1978, when the government was thinking about foreign intelligence targets, they weren't really thinking about law enforcement at all, because what we were thinking about was getting evidence about what the Russians were up to. And that was not a law enforcement issue at all. That was a national security diplomatic issue. What has happened in 2001 is that any issue relating to terrorism is now both a foreign policy issue and a domestic law enforcement issue of the highest importance, and the grounds for that separation simply don't exist anymore.
So the new anti-terrorism law won't make it any easier to get a tap on someone who's alleged to be in the mafia. It will only make it easier to get a tap on somebody who's alleged to be a terrorist.
That's right. And it somewhat expands the definition of terrorist, and that has caused some civil libertarians some concern. And it makes it easier for the government to share the results of national security taps with law enforcement, which again causes civil libertarians some upset. But, you know, when I set out to write this New Yorker story, I was thinking in terms of the great periods of repression we've had in this country during and after wartime, things like the Red Scare after World War I, the internment of the Japanese during World War II, Nixon's surveillance of anti-war protesters around the time of Vietnam. And when you place this anti-terrorism bill against those really dramatic violations of civil liberties, you know, I was left somewhat comforted. I did not think that this was a wholesale violation of Americans' rights.
Does the new anti-terrorism law affect communications and information sharing between the FBI and the CIA?
Well, it almost did. Here was an example of where the administration's proposal was cut back and limited. The administration originally proposed that wiretaps or bugs, surveillance that had been conducted by foreign governments, which, you know, goes through our CIA and is reported to the American government, could be used in American courts. But civil libertarians rebelled against this idea, and it was dropped because, you know, foreign intelligence collection in foreign countries is conducted under very wild and woolly circumstances. I mean, if we think our intelligence agencies don't respect human rights, you know, you talk about like the French intelligence. I mean, those people really play for keeps. And the Congress decided that they weren't going to essentially contract out our civil liberties to foreign intelligence operations, and that part was cut from the legislation.
Well, Jeffrey Toobin, I thank you so much for talking with us.
Always a pleasure.
Jeffrey Toobin is a staff writer for The New Yorker and a legal analyst for ABC News. His new book, Too Close to Call, is about last year's presidential election. This is Fresh Air.